Hello, it's John Dennis on Monday, the 2nd of February. Today, how Britain's biggest companies limit the amount of tax they pay.
What they've managed to do by a series of financial manoeuvres is transfer the ownership of the brand and of the entire business over to a company in the Netherlands.
Also today, ministers move to soothe the unions over the use of foreign workers at an oil refinery in Lincolnshire.
Governments seem to be saying to the unions, look, we hear what you say, we're going to look into your worries, and if there's something we can do about it, we will.
And the rise and rule of Hurricane Hugo, a decade of Venezuela's President Chavez.
Oil prices are tumbling. There are tough times ahead for Chavez and Venezuela. But for now, Hugo Chavez is still popular and still powerful.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, let's hear the news headlines and have a look at the papers with Sandy Waugh.
British taxpayers are being left to plug a multi-billion pound hole as hundreds of companies employ complex and secretive tax arrangements to limit the amount they hand over to the Exchequer. An extensive Guardian investigation has examined the accounts of the UK's biggest companies and discovered a series of sophisticated tax strategies. Critics say this amounts to an almost unstoppable tide of perfectly legal corporate tax avoidance. We'll have more on this in just a moment. Heavy snow has been causing travel chaos across much of the UK as the Met Office issues an extreme weather warning for London and the southeast of England. The heaviest snowfall for two decades moved into Britain on a freezing easterly wind. Trains have been cancelled, some airport runways temporarily closed. London Transport suspended its bus services because of dangerous conditions. Forecasters are predicting up to 20 centimetres may fall in some areas. The Highways Agency says around 500 gritters have been working through the night. Some lanes have been blocked by snow on London's busiest motorway, the M25. Women's increasing economic independence from their male partners is contributing to family breakup. The wide-ranging survey from the Children's Society also says this, in turn, is damaging children. The report also notes more mothers of babies under 12 months now work than do not, and their children are being looked after in childcare rather than by their parents. The charity criticises the lack of support in Britain for families and suggests the development of a civil ceremony for new babies, which would offer an alternative to a christening service for non-religious parents. The Pittsburgh Steelers have become the first team in NFL history to win six Super Bowls. They've beaten the Arizona Cardinals 27-23 in Tampa. In a remarkable fourth quarter, the Cardinals appear to have pulled off one of the greatest comebacks after recovering from a 27 deficit to lead 23-20. But with 35 seconds remaining, Santonio Holmes made a brilliant six-yard catch for the Steelers. Rafael Nadal has described his first Australian Open victory as a dream win. The Spaniard has claimed his first hard-court Grand Slam with a five-set victory over Roger Federer. That means Federer was denied the chance to equal Pete Sampras' record of 14 titles. A look at this morning's papers now. Strikes to hit power supplies, claims The Telegraph, as the dispute over the employment of foreign workers escalates. The Guardian says a nuclear power station not far from London has been leaking radiation for 14 years. The Times investigation has found some of Whitehall's biggest computer projects are spiralling out of control, overspending by £18 billion. The Mirror's furious at a new Big Brother-style show for children after the youngsters were left sobbing, hungry and scared. The Mail reports on how a nurse could be sacked and even struck off for offering to say a prayer for an elderly patient. The paper also says Chelsea boss Luis Felipe Scolari has accused referee Mike Riley of costing them the Premiership title after Liverpool beat the Blues 2-0. And The Sun says Tony Adams is facing the Portsmouth axe today with Avram Grant set to succeed him. More on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
The average Briton pays £5,000 a year in income tax, but hundreds of the country's biggest companies increasingly employ complex and secretive tax arrangements to limit the amount they hand over to the Exchequer, and British taxpayers are being left to plug a multi-billion pound hole in the public finances. Today, The Guardian launches a series of reports into the tax arrangements of some of the UK's biggest firms. Our investigations editor, David Lee, explains how Diageo, the company that makes Johnnie Walker Scotch whiskey, cuts its tax bill.
Well, this is really a story about a Scotch that went Dutch. They make Johnnie Walker whiskey, which is made in Scotland, of course. But what they've managed to do by a series of financial manoeuvres is transfer the ownership of the brand and of the entire business over to a company in the Netherlands, which they've specially set up. And the result of the manoeuvres is that in the Netherlands they pay a lot less tax. And they've done the same thing with J&B, which is another Scotch whisky brand, and with Gilby's Gin. They've steadily moved their brands offshore, as it were.
What's been the response of the British tax authorities?
Well, they appear to have been in a considerable dispute with Diageo. And our information is that just before Christmas, they in fact agreed a settlement and Diageo agreed to hand over some tax. I should say that Diageo, when we asked them about it, say, "We are in constant communication with Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, but we're not going to make any comments about it."
Now, The Guardian's been investigating the tax arrangements of 20 major companies, of which Diageo is one. What's been the purpose of this inquiry?
This is a series that's going to run every day for the next couple of weeks, and we are going to go into the tax strategies of all these companies, 20, more than 20, some of Britain's household names. What we've discovered is that they all use a variety of really sophisticated and elaborated schemes and strategies that which the ordinary person in the street would have a lot of trouble understanding in order to duck out of paying what many people would think of as their fair share of corporation tax.
And what kind of methods have they used in order to achieve this?
Well, this business of moving the brands offshore is something that's quite common. We found many other famous companies are moving their brands to the Caribbean sometimes, to Switzerland often. Another thing that they do is they split up their companies into all kinds of little components and they move as many of these as they can, again, offshore. Sometimes we find that they set up a network of offshore companies in places like Luxembourg, and they then set up very complicated things involving branches in other countries and partnerships in third countries, and they shuffle the money around between these, where companies with different accounting standards, different tax legislation, different tax regimes. And as a result of all this very arcane manoeuvring, they end up paying a lot less tax than they would do if they just stayed in Britain.
Have any of these firms done anything illegal?
The striking thing about this kind of artificial tax avoidance is that it's not illegal. There is a sort of tax evasion which is illegal, which is when, you know, individual people, they hide their money in offshore bank accounts and so on. These companies don't do that. What they do is, it's not illegal, but the revenue very often takes them to court about it. And they say, this tax scheme is ineffective, it doesn't work. And if the court agrees it doesn't work, then they have to give the money back. And that's the way it operates.
Now, with unemployment rising in the UK as the recession deepens, the government's getting less income to spend on public services. Does that provide an incentive for the government to get tough with some of these companies?
Governments all over the world are going to start getting tough with these international companies, because as the global recession or slump begins to bite, then the tax take of all development countries is going to fall. Furthermore, think tanks say that because of the recession and because of the enormous borrowing that's gone on in Britain, there will come a time when the tax burden in this country is going to have to rise a lot. And that means you and me are going to have to pay more tax to pay for all this. So, you know, there's going to be more pressure on companies to pay their fair share.
And is there any way of putting a figure on the amount of tax which is effectively being lost to the Inland Revenue?
What's known as the tax gap, the difference between what companies ought to be paying if they were being reasonable and what they actually do pay, is a hotly disputed area. Nobody knows the exact size of the tax gap, but Britain's top tax man, Dave Hartnett, in the Treasury, says it's certainly some billions as far as big corporations are concerned.
And as for the use of offshore tax havens, these have recently been condemned by both the Pope and President Barack Obama.
Well, President Obama, before he became president, one of the things he was doing was promoting a Stop Tax Havens Abuse Act, and he's very keen to clamp down on them. I think we should see the Americans moving under President Obama to do something about tax havens, many of which are under British control, actually.
David Lee, and there's full coverage of that story today at guardian.co.uk/business. Also on The Guardian's website, how Fox News is reporting President Obama, by Ed Pilkington. That's at guardian.co.uk/America. It's transfer deadline day, and at guardian.co.uk/football, as the window swings shut until the summer, you can follow all the latest ins and outs with our live coverage from 8 a.m. until 6 p.m. And fanzines versus blogs, the music writer Simon Reynolds begins a series of articles for guardian.co.uk/music. Government officials, unions, employers and the mediation service ACAS are in frantic talks after wildcat strikes spread across the country on Friday. The protests were prompted by a decision by the French energy company Total to bring in hundreds of Italian and Portuguese contractors to work on a new £200 million plant at the giant Lindsay oil refinery at North Killingholme, North Lincolnshire. The unions claim Britons were not given any opportunity to apply for the posts. The government says that while they understand the workers' anger, the strikes are indefensible. On Friday at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Gordon Brown warned against protectionism. But this was what he said at the Labour Party conference in 2007.
This is our vision. Britain leading the global economy. By our skills and creativity, by our enterprise and flexibility, by our investment in transport and infrastructure, a world leader in science, a world leader in financial and business services, a world leader in energy and the environment from nuclear to renewables, a world leader in the creative industries, and yes, a world leader in modern manufacturing too, drawing on the talents of all to create British jobs for British workers.
Our senior political correspondent, Andrew Sparrow, is in our Westminster office. Andy, those words have come back to haunt Gordon Brown.
One of the rules of politics, I suppose, is something that sounds good on the day often doesn't sound that good a few years later. We all remember George Bush and Mission Accomplished, which is something that he certainly regretted saying. And British jobs for British workers also really caught the imagination. Brown, of course, has said he kind of never meant to suggest that foreigners wouldn't be allowed to come to the UK and take up British jobs, but it certainly raised expectations which the people who were picketing or protesting on Friday felt had been let down.
And there's also the fear, Andy, that far-right groups such as the British National Party will use this phrase as ammunition to turn these protests to their advantage.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see this week whether these protests escalate or whether it all fizzles out and everyone decides to stay at home, which sort of the bad weather in this case is probably something that will play to the government's advantage. But you're right, there is a kind of interesting current of nationalism here where sort of concern for employment starts to coalesce with the dark agenda of the BNP. I'm after Gordon Brown made his original speech at the 2007 party conference and used the phrase British jobs for British workers. David Cameron had scored a success in the Queen's Speech debate a few weeks later when he held up a BNP leaflet and said, look, this is their phrase. It was also a phrase I think even the National Front had been using in the 70s. Gordon Brown, of course, is not remotely racist, but this is an area where the recession and the credit crunch and rising unemployment has started to make these fears much more real to people. And there's a nasty subcurrent to all of this, you're right.
There's been industrial unrest across Europe in recent days and weeks, even in Russia. To what extent should we see these strikes in Britain in a wider context?
That's interesting. I suspect there is something going on here to do with the global recession and insecurity and globalisation and people's feelings that the security and stability that they used to enjoy is disappearing. But there's been unrest in Paris, there's been unrest in Greece. You've mentioned Russia. Last Friday in the UK, we saw, it wasn't quite rioting, but it was sort of pretty ugly scenes, sort of reminiscent of kind of 1970s industrial protests. There isn't anything directly holding these things together, and I think you'd be unwise to try and say it's all the same grievances. But when people are worried about their savings, or worried about their jobs, worried about their future, then they're kind of more likely to protest. It's also a factor that a sense that once the media get a sense this is the story, then they start reporting sort of protests that otherwise perhaps would have been going on but wouldn't be reported. I'm not sure there's a sort of mass insurrection all over Europe yet, and it'd be mad to say so, but certainly the recession is probably creating the conditions where that becomes more likely.
And looking at the government's handling of this particular dispute, Andy, they've asked ACAS, the independent mediator, to try and find out whether the company Total acted legally. Can a legal loophole be found that will placate these striking workers?
The contract has been awarded, and it's difficult to see anything that's going to persuade sort of Total to withdraw it and send the workers back home. But I think the concern, if the government can say to unions, and remember this isn't an official protest, and unions aren't supposed to be supporting unofficial action of this kind, but yeah, clearly they share a lot of the concerns felt by some of the people on the picket lines. And the government seems to be saying, yesterday we had Alan Johnson saying, look, you know, there are problems with the way some of these EU directives work. Governments seem to be saying to the unions, look, we hear what you say, we're going to look into your worries, and if there's something we can do about it, we will. I'm not sure there is anything they can do about it. Changing EU directives isn't something you can do overnight.
Andrew Sparrow, and there's full coverage today at guardian.co.uk/politics. I'm John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, the Islamic Revolution 30 years on. But what's been the legacy of the Ayatollah Khomeini for ordinary Iranians?
There's a lot of posters and placards and bunting and fairy lights on government buildings and a programme of activities over the next 10 days.
And marooned on the River Fal, the sailors stranded on the ships that are going nowhere.
It's not normal for us because we're only staying here in one place. We usually go around the world.
But first, it's 10 years to the day since Hugo Chavez was first elected Venezuela's president. With Fidel Castro ailing and in semi-retirement, Chavez is now the undisputed leader of a resurgent left across Latin America. The Guardian's Rory Carroll reports from Caracas on Chavez's remarkable life, from skinny army cadet to tank commander to globe-trotting president.
It started with gunfire and explosions. An unknown young army officer named Hugo Chavez trying to overthrow Venezuela's government. It was 1992. The coup flopped militarily, but it made Chavez a household name. An extraordinary political journey had begun. Chavez emerged from prison, and instead of shooting his way to power, he seduced his way. Venezuela's poor were angry. The system was broken, corrupt. People wanted radical change. Chavez won a landslide in the 1998 presidential election and was inaugurated on the 2nd of February, 1999. The new president had charisma and oil. Lots and lots of oil. As oil prices rose, he built new health clinics, schools, and subsidized grocery stores. The poor adored him. Chavez also made a friend in Havana. His bond with Fidel Castro was tight, almost like father and son. Venezuelan oil subsidies prop up Cuba's economy, and in return, Havana sends medical doctors and technical expertise. The president also forged alliances with Latin America's new generation of leftist leaders. And he hosted some celebrity friends in Caracas. Chavez also made enemies. At home, he fired thousands of striking oil workers and infuriated the middle class by pushing for a self-styled socialist revolution. Demonstrators demanded he resign and clashed with police. George Bush backed a coup against Chavez, but it backfired. The comandante emerged stronger and really, really angry. He called Bush a devil, a donkey, an alcoholic, and Mr. Danger. And he ramped up his revolution. Chavez's 10th anniversary comes at a difficult time. Opposition is once again growing. Corruption and incompetence have left public services in tatters, violent crime has soared, the streets are filled with rubbish, and hospitals are crumbling. Even some of the poor have turned against the president. And now oil prices are tumbling. There are tough times ahead for Chavez and Venezuela. But for now, Hugo Chavez is still popular and still powerful. He basks in the admiration of millions.
Rory Carroll reporting. Another important anniversary now, this time in Iran. On the 1st of February 1979, Ayatollah Khomeini returned to Iran from exile in Paris. 10 days later, the regime of the American-backed Shah collapsed. Iran is marking the 30th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution with 10 days of celebrations, as our Middle East editor Ian Black reports from Tehran.
Well, this is a very big deal for the Iranian regime. 3 decades since 1979, the government still looks back at what was, for it, an absolutely enormous historic event whose repercussions are still being felt. It was the overthrow of Western-backed monarchy, which its enemies saw as oppressive, and its replacement by the first ever Islamic regime. And that is indeed the tone of the official celebrations, that this was a huge happening of world historical significance, and that's the tone of how the event is being marked. It began with ceremonies at the mausoleum of Ayatollah Khomeini, who everybody remembers as the elderly cleric who was the face of the Iranian Revolution, and the current leadership paid homage to him at his tomb and promised to, you know, to renew their allegiance to the aspirations of 1979.
How much enthusiasm is there among ordinary Iranians for the revolutionary fervour of 1979?
Well, I think that's a very central question. There's a lot of posters and placards and bunting and fairy lights on government buildings, and a programme of activities over the next 10 days, this 10-day period that marks the anniversary of the revolution. And I think there was a good turnout at Khomeini's tomb the other day, and they've expected to be a pretty significant turnout when celebrations culminate on February the 10th. But apart from that, frankly, people are getting on with their lives. This is a country with very serious problems, economic problems. There are very significant presidential elections coming up in the summer. There's great interest in whether Barack Obama is really going to be able to open that new chapter in those very troubled relations between Iran and the United States. And I was talking earlier today to school children who were being shown round the Martyrs Museum in Tehran, looking at the relics and mementos of the revolution. And frankly, you know, they were like kids anywhere on a school trip to a historic site, and they were more interested in giggling amongst themselves than in what their teacher was telling them.
Is there much demand for more democracy and personal freedoms among ordinary Iranians?
Iran is a curious mixture. It really is. On the one hand, the state is repressive. People are locked up. Newspapers are closed down. Bloggers are harassed and jailed. Minorities are persecuted. Capital punishment is used quite extensively. On the other hand, there are significant islands and areas of really considerable freedom that are surprising. They exist in a way side by side with the far more repressive elements of the regime. There's a very active parliament. But the political system is still weighted on the side of authoritarianism, of the power of the clergy and the bodies that really call the shots in this country. So there's a lot bubbling along beneath the surface, and it's a curious sort of mixture of things that on the face of it don't really go together, but somehow manage to rub along. And I think that the anniversary of the revolution is an interesting time to ponder that sort of duality, if you like, that exists in this country. It's really very unusual.
Ian Black in Tehran. The global financial crisis has left about 30 sailors marooned up the River Fal in Cornwall. Some are stuck there because there's no work for them. Others because their ship has been seized by the courts. as Stephen Morris reports.
We're chugging along the River Fal on a pleasure cruiser. It's a lovely, still, dark evening. This is a beautiful river in the south of Cornwall. Just upstream is Truro, somewhere over there is Falmouth. But we're not here to enjoy the peace and quiet. All around us are giant ships, car carriers, bulk carriers, banana boats that are laid up here because of the global recession. They have no work to do or have been seized because their companies are in trouble. So they're anchored here in this deep water. There's 10 or so of these ships all around. Skeleton crews are left on board to maintain the ships. There are Ukrainians, Portuguese, Filipinos, Russians, becalmed here, so to speak. We're going to try and speak to some of them, but the first challenge is getting to the sailors, who rarely come ashore. We've tried ringing on the phone to get on the boat, but that didn't work, so Ross has just hit the horn. And that's him banging on the side of the ship. Eventually the Portuguese captain comes out, admits he's pretty bored at being stranded here, but won't let us onto his vessel. That's a shame because we've heard crew members whiz around the empty car deck on their bikes to keep fit. That would have been a good sight to see. We'll try the bulk carrier Challenger 2 next door.
It's sparkling clean, isn't it?
Well, it's kind of lonely because we are only four of us here. And when we arrived last January 6, our companions, the rest of the crew, went home.
Right.
So it's kind of...
They've all gone back to the Philippines.
Yeah, they're going back to the Philippines already.
So is it good to stay? You've got work, so you're staying. Is it good or
is bad? It's good because we have the job, but it's not normal for us because we're only staying here in one place. We usually go around the world.
So how long do you think you'll be here now?
They are counting from 2 weeks to 2 months.
And are you going to be here for all that time, no matter how long it takes?
For 2 months, it's okay for us. Right. Then after that, maybe we want some replacement already.
Have you been into the town, into the cities nearby?
These two guys already went to Truro.
How was Truro?
Good. Good. Many beautiful.
Many beautiful girls.
These men seem okay. Of course, they'd rather be on the high seas doing proper tough seafaring, but they're cheerful enough. Poor Chaplain Louise Carter says others aren't so lucky.
There's a real issue with boredom. There's not enough work to do even on the roughest ship that needs care. So the crew are really struggling, really, to survive the long hours. And many of them will tell you that it's a real problem for them to get to the shore. So it's very much like a floating prison for them.
Stephen Morris reporting. Phil Maynard and Andy Duckworth produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.